Welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to begin by expressing my appreciation to everyone who's made this broadcast possible. So, tonight on Tuesday Topics, we will be discussing the issue of how blind people are treated by the medical community. It's a pretty controversial topic, and I've asked one person specifically to join us this evening to talk a little bit about some of the background to this issue, and that person is Gail Krause, who is the Assistant Director of the Office of ADA Coordination in Miami-Dade County. And I'd like actually to begin by asking her a couple of questions to kind of set a tone for us. Gail, does the ADA actually speak to the issue of how the medical community ought to treat us?
It does to a degree. It speaks about, again, program access, removing barriers, et cetera. I will tell you that the new guidelines, the new ADAG, is going to talk specifically to furniture and how furniture needs to be arranged, how high things need to be, and those kinds of things. That won't affect us as much as other people. But if you look at ADA, it does definitely talk about medical facilities and doctors, offices, and all of those kinds of things that we use.
Okay, so there are, I guess, two titles that would apply, and that's Title II and Title III. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between the two as they apply to medicine?
Title III says that people have to remove barriers, and they have to remove them when they're readily achievable to move. Okay, and the problem with that is that readily achievable means it doesn't cost a lot and it's not hard to do. Okay, that's talking usually about physical barriers, but that can include, for example, in a doctor's office, an elevator panel that's not in Braille, or I can't think, that's the thing that I run into the most often.
Room numbers,
those kinds of things, signage, yes. And the thing about readily achievable is it's ongoing. The problem is nobody says how often you have to look at it. Okay, so if you look at that today, does that mean that next year at this time you should relook at it? There's no real guidelines as to how often that is. So it's up to us, the community of people who need these things, to push that. You know, when did you last look at this? Effective communication goes across both titles, and that's, I think, our biggest issue typically. And that says that people need to provide us information in a way that is as effective as other people get it, okay? There's a slight difference in the spirit of Title II and Title III, but the result is typically the same. Title III says something about the doctor or the medical person gets to make the final decision how they provide it. Title II says you really have to honor the request of the person making that request unless you can show undue hardship, okay? But the result is typically the same, okay? Then Title II talks about the obligation is program access. We do a lot of barrier removal from our office, and typically what needs to happen, instead of people going in and looking at immediately all the physical things, somebody needs to go in and look at, okay, what are all the programs here? And what are the barriers to those programs? And those are the ones you have to remove. It doesn't mean that the whole thing has to be made physically accessible. I know very few hospitals who would truly come under Title III, because that would mean they get no state funding, they get no federal funding, they get no county funding. I just don't think there are very many of them. Funding comes from somewhere. Okay, so whether it's county or state funding, they're going to come under Title II of the ADA, and if it's federal funding, they're going to come under 504, which, again, results in much of the same obligations. So again, that's going to mean somebody has to look at every aspect of that hospital. What are the programs? What happens when somebody comes in? You start with looking at, you know, parking, whether it's dropping off a blind person or parking for somebody with a physical disability. You look at path of travel. How do you get somewhere? You look at admitting. What's the process? Is it accessible to everybody? Is the paperwork accessible? About 6 or 7 years ago, went to Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, and I went into admitting by myself, and signed all the things after she read them to me, and then she wanted to give me this booklet, and I said, well, I'd like it in some way I can read it. And she said, well, we don't have it. And I said, well, I don't want it. And she literally chased me around the room with this book saying, I have to give this to you. You know, and I said, you're not giving it to me.
And you ended up taking some action as a result of that, right?
We did. We did end up with a class action lawsuit against Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. It ended up being a little more toward the physical access part of things, as many of these things do, and I think we have to be really careful and vigilant. I learned some things from that, and that certainly wouldn't happen to me again. I didn't pay quite enough attention, and there were some things that I wasn't able to notice, and the people doing the surveys didn't notice, like there are white courtesy phones on white walls. Okay, people can't see them. You know, don't assume that a team of surveyors, whether they're people with disabilities or architects or whoever they are, know what they're doing. Many people do not, and it's very scary out there. I happen to work with some of the best people I think there are in the country for those kinds of things.
Cool. Gail, thanks very much for providing that kind of initial background for us. And having said that, let's kind of go around and see if people have had any experiences with the medical community that they'd like to perhaps call to our attention as things that weren't very nice.
Brian from Boston. Recently, when I applied for some extended health insurance, I was determined in the blood tests that took place actually here at my home, a part of the insurance process, that I had elevated blood sugar. So I went into my doctor's office for a blood workup, and as part of that, they determined I had type 2 diabetes. And part of that regular process is to send you off to a nutritionist. And I had an appointment with the nutritionist, and she carefully described to me what my nutrition ought to be and kept piling up papers, handouts that were regularly given to any and all patients who were determined to have type 2 diabetes on how they were to change their diet and exercise. And after the pile got pretty tall and beginning to topple, I said, and where's the accessible versions of that? And she said, what do you mean accessible? I said, well, I'm blind, of course, so I need them in Braille. And she had no clue what to do, where to do, how to do, was quite apologetic, but had no answers for me. I then went up to my general physician's office and spoke with the diabetes educator there, and I said, just out of curiosity, when you're a type 2 diabetic, do you have to start taking and using a glucometer? And they said, yes. And I said, well, how come you didn't issue me one? Well, I don't know anything about getting them and, you know, that you could use. I said, if I were a sighted person and had it, you'd automatically give me one, right? Because I understand they're only about $10, $20, modern computer printers. The value really is in buying the consumable part of things. And I said, I have no intention of leaving this office until somebody agrees that they're going to get me an accessible glucometer, since I know they exist. And eventually I did get it. They didn't deny that they should have done it. They acknowledged that they should have done it, and I made them go through the entire process rather than doing it for them.
And the insurance company actually covered the cost of that glucometer, Brian?
Absolutely they did. Even though the talking glucometer was in the hundreds of dollars, I never had any problem. They eventually located the appropriate unit, strangely enough, after talking to the agency I worked for to get their advice as to which one the agency would recommend. Contacted the provider and had it shipped to me directly and the bill shipped to them. So I haven't had to pay a dime for it.
Alice, maybe you could tell us a little about what happened to you.
Well, it started when I went into the emergency room. And I always make it a habit when I don't take my dog with me, which is very rare. But when you go in the middle of the night to the emergency room, I didn't take my dog. And as so happened, I didn't even take my cane. But I made it a point to tell them the minute I walked to the door and went up, you know, got up to the registration desk that I was blind. And so I thought that was that. But a little later, while I was laying on this cot in severe pain, this doctor walks in and stationed himself at some point in the room. I have no idea where, and said, I'm Dr. Ham. Look at me. needless to say, I was a little incensed and outraged by his attitude to begin with. So that's kind of how it started. And then I went through and was there for 3 hours. And as I got ready to leave, the nurse came in and said, okay, here's your instructions and here's the prescription and the number for the surgeon you need to call. I'll lay it on this chair here. Well, then it dawned on me that these people had no clue, apparently, that I couldn't see. And I said, well, where is on the chair? I said, I'm blind. I said, I told them that when I came in. She goes, you mean you can't see right now? And I said, no, I can't see no matter what it is. And so then she just kind of highlighted what was on it, and they let me go. So needless to say, I called the hospital and filed a complaint. And there were several other things, too, just the whole experience was just awful. And then they wanted me to come back for surgery. And at that point, I didn't know that I would trust them to cut me open if they couldn't even do a simple thing like identify the fact that I couldn't see. So I filed a complaint, and I did have to go back the next week for tests. And when I went in, it was funny because they actually sent an administrative person into the admissions office with me. And for the first time in my life, they literally read me every single piece of paper, from the Medicare information all the way through to the consent form for any procedures. And then, like Gail said, though, then they started to hand me all this stuff in a print format, like about the living will and all that. And I said, do you have this in an alternate format? And she goes, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, like, I would prefer it in Braille, but I know Braille's expensive. And I said, and probably a lot of people that come in here who are elderly may not read Braille, but you should at least be offering it to me in large print or on cassette. And the administrator says, well, we didn't think about that. That's probably a good idea. So the thing that really outraged me, though, was I did get a response a couple weeks ago from the head of the emergency room, and his first thing in the letter was, there is no way for us to know or to chart when somebody comes through the doors who has a special need. And so my response at this point back to him was, I actually sent a certified letter yesterday. I wanted to wait till I was feeling better, and so I finally did this week. And my first response to him was that was no excuse to not have some kind of policy, and that the ADA had been around long enough that they should have a plan and a policy in place. And I said, I don't know how difficult it would be for you to put in that chart that I'm blind so that any doctor that picks up that chart would see it. I said, or to even put a sticky on the outside that says this patient is blind.
Gail, Alice had sort of mentioned in passing that hospitals ought to have plans. Is that accurate under the ADA?
It is. And I, you know, one of the things that I think we all need to do, I think about going to the hospital kind of like flying. You're not at your best, and you don't want to deal with all this stuff at that moment. You know, if you are in a community where you know you're going to be using that hospital, or maybe just as a group, maybe your chapter wants to do it, you know, contact the administrator. Talk to them about what's your plan for a sign language interpreter. What's your plan for a blind person? They must have a plan, and it's got to be in their budget. There is absolutely no excuse. They can't say we don't have enough money. You've got to tell them you've got a budget for this every year, whether you use it or not.
Now, if it's a Title II entity, aren't they also required to have an individual who is designated as the person responsible for the ADA within their entity?
Yeah, there must be an ADA coordinator, and that's the other thing that you can ask for. Some hospitals have patient advocates. They're not always the same thing. Unfortunately, a lot of hospitals, their ADA coordinator is somebody in personnel, or it's somebody in their, you know, it's not always an appropriate person. So you need to get to know who that is and who makes the policies and what are they. You know, they have to have them in writing. I think we all tend to be a little bit reactive rather than proactive, myself included. And I think the same thing with doctor's offices. I have changed doctors because I couldn't deal with their staff and didn't want to take the time to do anything about it. But I think it's really, you can tell a lot about an office when you go in and what happens. I want to tell, before I turn this back to Paul, I might say a good thing that happened to me was about a year ago, I went into my allergist, and this was when all the HIPAA stuff was coming up, and the office manager walked out and she said, Gail, I've got to have everybody look at this HIPAA form and be sure that everybody's seen it. And I was just thinking about you, and how about if I email it to you? Is that okay? And needless to say, I stayed there. you know, if you go complain about one little thing, that's just one blind person, and it's one nurse, and it's one, and they're going to forget about it, you know, for the most part, unless it's a really horrible thing, and you don't want horrible things to happen.
I've had very interesting bad experiences with people basically either demanding that my husband help me or demanding that I take paperwork home for someone to complete later or that sort of thing. But I had two big questions for Gail, if I could. First of all, this requirement for the accessible paperwork and that sort of thing, does that also apply to hospitals or just, I mean, also to doctor's offices or just to the hospitals?
It applies to everything. Effective communication, you know, those are the words you need to use.
Yeah, those are the buzzwords.
Yep, and yes, they do apply to doctor's offices as well.
And a doctor's office has a little bit more flexibility in terms of how they need to present the information. They wouldn't necessarily have to provide it to you in Braille, but they have to assure that you get the communication. And usually they don't, I mean, that's part of, I think, what Gail's saying. Usually doctor's offices and hospitals have no idea what effective communication is for blind people. And so we really have to do some education. But most documents now in doctor's offices are probably generated electronically. And it therefore ought to be relatively easy for us to get electronic versions if we make an effort to do that. And so I think Gail's right. If we start to plan and start to educate, perhaps even get to local medical association meetings and talk about the requirements, perhaps even strong-arm offices like Gail's and say, what are you doing to educate the public hospitals that are in your area?
It's hospital administrators, really. It's not so much the medical community. It's got to come from the top down.
Janelle, you said you had two questions. You want to ask your second one?
Thanks, Paul. My second question then was, when you said accessible formats, I mean, I'm flexible, I'm a computer person and all that kind of stuff, so it does not have to be in Braille for me, but if they're not required to give format of choice, I mean, they can't, I take it then, just say, well, here's the print, you have to go scan it. Are they allowed to say, well, I will read it to you? Because, I mean, obviously, Brian, with the diabetes, if your head is a little bit in a fog, you may not remember it, and the sighted person doesn't have to do that. So what are they forced to do? I mean, are they forced to give it to you in some kind of a permanent format, or what, you know, and that really then is my question, that I take it, it's then anything that the sighted person could take home in a permanent format, we should get in some kind of accessible permanent format. Is that what it comes down to?
That's it. Again, effective communication. If it's something that you need to know or to have, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't want all that stuff. But if it's important and it's something that I need to know or need to have, then yeah, either they need to sit and read it to me while I tape it, or read it to me while I write down the pertinent facts, or you know, do something.
Janelle raises an interesting question, though. Would it be effective communication if they read it to you when you were so ill that you probably couldn't comprehend it?
No, that's not effective communication.
And so essentially, there has to be another component then, and that second component would be probably assuring that you can understand it by having you write or respond, or giving it to you in some format that you can access later.
Or even arranging with whoever's reading it to you to call them later, so that, you know, when you're at home and you've got your writing method of choice available, whatever that is, be creative. It's not going to be the same for everyone.
Cool. Okay, thanks for your questions, Janelle. Who else would like to talk about some experiences?
I had a situation where my jaw locked open on me, and I had to go to the hospital and have that thing here, but they couldn't, the staff at the hospital that had trouble being able to close it, so they had to get somebody from Jackson to help me, and I had a problem with Flint also, but that's the embarrassing part. If your mouth is locked open, then you can't really talk to anybody. I mean, fortunately, here my mother was with me, and I had a guy at the where I was staying at the YMCA that I knew. He was able to help me talk for me, you know, when I couldn't talk for myself. But that's an embarrassing situation when your mouth is locked open.
It sure is. Got to learn sign language, Gary. That was Gary Wood from Michigan. Other experiences that people might like to share.
This is Marlena, and I just was in the hospital in December, being a severe asthmatic. I get to do that on a more regular basis than I prefer. And I wanted to make a couple of really quick comments. I was absolutely shocked when I was walking from the bathroom in my room back to my bed, and the nurse came in and said, "Oh my gosh, you mustn't be totally blind. You're walking around by yourself." On the paperwork thing, I had an interesting experience. A year and a half ago, I needed some minor surgery on my hand, and I knew that there was going to be a lot of paperwork to fill out, and I knew there was really no private place to go in this particular doctor's office to do the paperwork. So I called up and I asked them if they could fax me the paperwork, because I thought, well, you know, Gary and I will do it at home and it'll be no big deal. And so they said they couldn't fax it. I had to fill it out there. So I then said, okay, and I got my stubborn hat on and I said, okay, I am a blind person. Let me just tell you up front that you will then need someone to help me fill this paperwork out, because I was not going to give them the easy way out of having a sighted husband. Well, all of a sudden it became real possible to fax it to me, and I said, no, you said you couldn't do it, so now you figure it out in your office. And boy, they did, but they weren't very happy about it.
Cool. Thanks, Marlena. So Gail, is this is what Marlena did an appropriate thing, do you think? Or?
Well, I'm very much like Marlena. Once you're annoyed, it's real tough to kind of think this through clearly. But, you know, the truth is, if you think about it, the hospital was trying to make a modification. They probably had a policy that you didn't do that, and they were trying to make a modification in their policies and procedures, which in some situations would be appropriate.
Debbie Grubb is with us, and I have a question for Debbie. How do service animals and the way that they're treated by the medical community figure here?
Hi. Well, I'm sure Alice can comment on this, as well as Marlena, so, and Brian, and Rachel. So this will be an interesting topic for us to explore a little bit and get some different viewpoints. GDUI has spent a lot of time assisting people who have entered the hospital and who have not been allowed to have their service animals with them, and we have worked with hospitals to come up with a policy whereby the animal can stay and has to be taken out on a regular basis. If the person is too ill to do that, then someone has to have arranged to have that done for the person. So we have had lots of problems in hospitals.
Supposing that you're going to an allergist to be treated for allergies, would it be appropriate for you to take a guide dog with you to an allergist's office?
My opinion would be that it would be perfectly appropriate, because that dog is your mobility aid, and people come to allergist offices who live with animals, and we all know that no matter how fastidious we are, a certain amount of that dander, which is the allergy-causing problem, not the animal itself, but it's dander, that those people are going to come in with a certain amount of that dander on their person, on their clothes, and so it is impossible to rid the world of every allergy-causing thing. And I would have no problem sitting far away from somebody if they said they had a terrible allergy to dogs. But I would really fight my right, especially if I needed that dog to get me to the allergist. I, for example, could not get to my doc's office without my dog.
Paul, if I could just jump in here for 1 second, because I was thinking about this while Debbie was talking, answering your first question. As a person with asthma, I go to a lung specialist, and before my first appointment, I was very troubled about what shall I do, and so I called the doctor's office, and I said, I am a blind person, I use a guide dog, will this create an issue, and if so, can we creatively resolve the problem? And they pretty much gave me the answer that Debbie did. I was quite happy about it, and they said, you know, we assume your dog is clean, we assume your dog's well groomed, and As long as those things are true, people don't live in bubbles. And if we do find that you're scheduled with someone who has minimal tolerance, then we will take you and your dog and bring you to the most comfortable room to wait, and they can wait out in the waiting room. Now, it also happens that they love dogs there, but I was just really struck by what Debbie said, because that's exactly the opinion of my two lung specialists and their entire staff.
There have been a couple of situations here in Miami where individuals with dog guides who have wanted to go to allergist offices and have essentially been told that they cannot take their dogs to an allergist office because of the fact that, by definition, a large number of the people who are being seen in that office are going to be hypersensitive often to animal issues, and that it's not fair to the patients that the allergist typically sees as a group to inflict a dog on those folks.
Well, and I think it's different when a dog has to sit, you have to sit in a waiting room if you're terribly allergic to an animal. I happened to refer someone with a guide dog to my allergist, and she said absolutely not. The dog could not come in. But, you know, she did work around it. What they did was whenever my friend Marcia went there, they would meet her at a different door and just take her directly into the office, so she didn't go through the waiting room and sit with everybody. And frankly, she probably got better treatment. You know, that was one of the options. They came up with some other options working with her, but my doctor said she had so many people that were so severely allergic to animals that she just couldn't do it.
What about intensive care units, you guys? Should service animals be allowed there as well?
I'll just jump in real quick. When I was caring for my friend through the last year of his life, he was in intensive care quite a bit, and so was I, and so was my dog, because the cubicle was a private cubicle, and granted his cubicle was close to the entryway of intensive care, but there was never an issue.
This is Alice, and I was going to say, when I had surgery a couple of years ago up in Savannah at one of the hospitals, it was real interesting because I didn't take my dog, and that was because my brother was the one who went with me, and he's not a dog person. And so the day of my actual surgery, I left the dog at home. And it was funny because when I got there, they all said, well, where's your dog? You could have brought him. He could even be in recovery with you. The only place we wouldn't allow him is in the operating room. And I said, well, I understand that. But at this point, he's better off at home than he would have been here, because my brother just isn't a good person with dogs. But the only place where I've ever had an issue with my guide, in fact, even this stay at the hospital this time, they give doggy treats to Sidian while I was at the hospital. That was the other only positive thing I can say about the hospital. But the only place I've ever, ever in my life had a problem with my guide dog was when I went into an eye doctor's office of all places. And she was just adamant about the fact my dog couldn't be there. And even after I contacted GDUI and ADA coordinator here and stuff, she was just, you know, she was adamant because of people with allergies, so on and so forth. And now I will add, this was a Pakistani doctor, but she did not want to give in. And I refused then to let her see me, because her solution was, well, you leave the dog outside and I'll take you by the hand. And I said, well, that tells me, first of all, you don't even know how to guide a person who's blind, so I'm certainly not going to go without my dog. And in the end, I just refused to go to her. And what we did was, she actually was receiving all of the rehab clients. That's where they were sending them for their visual exams. And so what we did was, we actually got to where that was a loss in our income, because we said, look, if you're going to discriminate against dog users, then you obviously don't need the business.
I want to take you to a place where most of us have been. You go into a new doctor's office for the first time. And every time you go into a new doctor's office for the first time, one of the things you can expect to have to do is to fill out a bunch of paperwork. Well, what usually happens is they say, do you have somebody with you to fill it out? And when you say no, They then realize that somebody from their office is going to have to be responsible for helping you to fill it out. My question is, how ought we to handle that whole issue? Because very often what they'll do is they will send some junior person out into the waiting room who treats blind folks the way that blind folks get treated. And so they say, have you ever had any infectious diseases? And it's pretty, everybody in the waiting room is waiting with bated breath for your response. So I'd be interested in hearing from folks as to, A, whether they've had that sort of experience, and, B, how they've handled it in the past.
I've absolutely refused to accept any assistance in the waiting room, and I've always made it very clear to the people when they offer that for reasons of privacy, I'd like to fill out the paperwork in a different room and would be happy to wait as long as it took to make that happen. Again, that's my accommodation to them. It's not so much the infectious diseases as sexually transmitted diseases that I get a little worked up over. And that includes in dental offices. If anything, dental offices I found to be more difficult than medical offices.
I will let them know when I make my first appointment that I am a person who is blind, that I will not be bringing anyone with me. And so for them to do whatever it is they need to do to, A, find a private space where we can fill the papers out, and, B, find a competent person who can read the papers to me, listen to my answers, and record them correctly.
I've had the same problem for the past few years. I have been to the same gynecologist for, gosh, last, what, 7 or 8 years. And every year they insist that you fill out the same forms. Last year I got really irate and I said, listen, I need to have these filled out in a private room. I have a friend that comes with me, the same person every year, and we always fill out the same exact forms. This last year I gave them my email address. I said, hopefully next year maybe you can email them to me and I can print them out and fill them out at home. But I will no longer fill them out in the waiting room.
Cool. And you're Marcia from Michigan, and welcome. This is, I think, the first time you've been with us. We're glad to have you here. Has anybody else had experiences with paperwork and inappropriate staff in doctor's offices?
I've had someone with me in the doctor's office, so that helps a little bit. But then I get the same kind of deal where, you know, sometimes they you have a lot of things to fill out, like the dentist office and the doctor's office too, and they ask you sometimes the doctor's office, the personal questions do you have any personality problems, or do you have depression, or are you depressed, or things of that nature, different things, and then there's the typical thing. I mean, it's almost like what Debbie's saying is like the typical if you compare to going to restaurants where they say, and what does he want today, or something. Then someone who's with you, you have to say, I don't know, ask him. But one thing about going to a doctor, if I'm going to be examined, you know, physical exam, I kind of like them to let me know what they're doing before they do it, you know. I mean, they would be, feel better, you know, if they have to do certain procedures. I kind of like to know ahead of time that they're about to do that procedure, and I think for the most part they do a good job with that. But I think that I haven't had too many unpleasant experiences, but I think it's good to keep these in mind, you know. These are good thought-provoking things. I'd never heard of a situation like what Alice mentioned, something about, that sounds terrible. Someone say, look at me, or something like that. Then you have to tell them that you're blind, and that sounds like, it's an annoying situation that shows a lack of intelligence, I would think, on the person to say something like that.
Well, this is Alice from Georgia, and just to answer that, Gary, it was a matter of arrogance, because as a blind person, I always look at the person who's speaking to me, but at that moment I was in pain and didn't feel good, and I thought that was rather arrogant of him. But as far as the paperwork, probably the most embarrassing experience I had was at a gynecologist office, and they handed the paperwork to my driver and wanted my driver to fill it out. And I was very uncomfortable with that, and I said, I'm not going to answer these questions. I don't want my driver to know my personal history. So I said, you need to get somebody from the office here to help me with this, and I certainly don't don't want to do it out here in the waiting room. And with that said, they were very good about waiting until they actually then took me back to the examining room and filling it out. But I just thought, how rude of them to assume that I'm wanting, you know, my driver to know my personal business.
I think it's really important that we put on the table that with the passage of HIPAA, and I don't remember what it stands for, if there's somebody who's bright and who knows what HIPAA stands for, I'd be perfectly happy for you guys to enlighten all of us. But HIPAA actually makes the kind of thing that has happened in the past, like filling out information in a public place, absolutely inappropriate. And it does guarantee privacy and requires doctors to actually make you sign forms that indicates precisely who your information won't be shared with. And by extension, that means that the information that you're giving verbally shouldn't be shared with the world either. So there actually are laws now that are extremely strong in terms of creating an obligation on the part of doctors' offices to provide you with an appropriate and effective place to fill out that information.
I think it stands for Health Information Privacy Act.
I think you may well be right. One of the things that Gail suggests is that a good thing to do is if you start to get some hassle with folks who are a little lower down on the totem pole in doctor's offices, and they tend to be the folks who get sent out to deal with it when it arrives, ask to speak with the office manager and mention HIPAA, and that way you're going to be much more likely to get what you need and what you want. One of the things that's kind of come up as we've talked a little this evening is we've talked some about eye doctors. And my question is, eye doctors who in fact ought to perhaps be the best at dealing with us who are blind may not be. And I wonder if people would like to comment on any specific experiences you might have had with ophthalmologists.
Well, actually, I've been trying to get the mic here for a while, but I think it's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And I've had several bad experiences, like others, with a sighted person in my life. They want to talk to him. They want him to fill out the paperwork. They assume he will fill out the paperwork. They demand sometimes that he will fill out the paperwork. But on occasion, if he isn't there, on one occasion, I was told that the nurse would fill it out. And then she said, well, I don't really have time to fill out all this for you, so you have to take it home for your family to finish. And I said, no, I really don't, because of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We really need to take care of this here. And I've just had all sorts of lovely experiences, like when I requested to do it in private once instead of in the waiting room, was actually cursed at by someone at the desk and that sort of thing. So hopefully these things will be getting better in the future, and it's just good to really know for certain what our rights are, and that I apparently have been on the right track.
Actually, I've had very positive experiences with my ophthalmologist. I haven't been to one in years, but the doctor that I went to when I was a young girl and growing up, he treated me equally. My father and I usually went together, and most of the forms and everything were filled out post-haste. Of course, this is back, we're talking in the 50s and 60s, and he treated me very kindly, and bless his heart, I'm sure he's deceased by now, but I couldn't have asked for a better doctor.
If people were all as respectful and courteous as the people in the ophthalmologist office, I would have no complaints. I agree.
I've had wonderful experiences with ophthalmologists, too. I haven't been to one down here, but the doctor that I went to in Ireland, his office was started by Dr. Hoover, who is the person who invented the long white cane as we know it. And so Dr. Doxana had a real knowledge of blind people and our capabilities, and I was treated with a great deal of respect. And one thing I found, though, I visited another ophthalmologist. It was a doctor I decided to change, and he was so interested in my eye disorder, because it's unusual, that he wanted me to go and have all of these pictures taken of my eyes so that he could show them to his staff. And I said, well, who's going to pay for all this? And I found out that it would be kind of painful to have it done, and I found out said that this doctor was more interested in using me as a guinea pig for his classes than he was in me as a person. And so it's one of two times in my life when I changed doctors and started going to this facility that I described earlier.
I think Gail made a point earlier that I'd like to kind of reiterate, and that is you can tell an awful lot about how good a doctor is going to be by how the staff is in the office. I recently changed doctors because of the attitude of staff in the office who, you know, I was really feeling ill and I wanted to see the doctor on an emergency basis. Transportation didn't work out on a given day, so I didn't make it there. And I called to try to get in the next day. And essentially she said, well, no, you can get in later this afternoon. And if you can't get in this afternoon, then you're obviously not sick enough. So just don't bother to call us. And I changed doctors. Because there was simply not even common courtesy, far less an acceptance of visual impairment. Okay, we've talked a lot about some of the things that happen. Now, as we normally do, as we get towards the end of our evening, let's talk about what we as the blindness community can do to make some of these things better. Any thoughts?
Brian here. I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine who runs a department in a not-for-profit agency producing Braille on demand on a fee-for-service basis. And he was concerned because the organization he worked for was talking about eliminating that service because it wasn't paying for itself. And I recommended that he put together a plan and go around to the local hospitals. And if there's one thing that we have plenty of up here in the Boston area, it's the medical community, to go around and arrange a service where if a blind or visually impaired person came in and said, I need this document in Braille, that they could get a copy done on an as-needed basis rather than creating a whole bunch of copies and having them sit there and date themselves. But to create that kind of transcription service, a Braille on-demand transcription service specifically for medical information. I think that's one thing that we could do is to ask. If you don't ask, you're not going to get. And to go through life saying, well, it's too much of a bother to ask, concerns me. So I think that's one thing we can do. Build up an infrastructure that supports accessible documents.
Yeah, I think that that's true, too. I think that they ought to be able to somehow find a way to make things accessible to blind people, and maybe we should suggest that to the doctors we go see, and that we make things that they put things in an accessible format so that we can look at these when we wish to look at them, and or either on Braille or on tape or something like that. Braille would probably be best, because then you can take your time. Well, you can look at tape too, but I mean just to be able to read it at our leisure. That's what the situation is.
This is Alice, and I think with what Gail said at the beginning is definitely the way to go, and it's kind of what I'm doing with after my situation here, and that's why I did write a certified letter back in response to this doctor's letter. I think that if we know we're going to be going there, then it's up to us to follow through with administration and make sure that they do improve their services. And in my letter, I actually have given them a timeline to respond to the things that I asked them to do, which was the number one thing was to come up with a policy and a plan for people with special needs. And the other thing that I did talk to the administrative person about was to at least try to get those kinds of things that they know are standard that they give out in print to people to at least offer them or have them available in some other kind of a format. And I intend to follow through with that. And my other suggestion was that they do get somebody to come in and actually do an in-service with them on the ADA.
I think, too, that every form and every piece of paper that a doctor's office or a hospital hands out was generated on a computer. And just as we have worked with textbook publishers to get a format available that can be easily turned into Braille, I think we could do the same thing with doctor's offices. They purchase these forms, get these booklets, and get the materials that they hand out, that they be given the material in an electronic version so that that material can either be emailed to somebody, can be sent to one of these Braille on-demand services, or can be done in a way way that best meets the needs of people with disabilities, with who are blind and who are visually impaired. It's not that difficult. I bet you there's not a single form that a doctor hands out or a pamphlet that wasn't generated on a computer. And we just need to begin this education process that these medical forms need to be saved and given to the people that purchase them in electronic tech so that they can be used to meet the needs of people who are blind and visually impaired.
Well, yeah, I think that education is the key right there. I mean, if you can educate doctors and staff at hospitals or staff at doctor's offices on how to, deal with people who are blind or anything, maybe that would, maybe it's because they're uninformed and they don't really know how to deal with disabled people. And I think that the courtesy in an office says a lot. I think it's one reason that people either keep coming back to a person because of the way they're treated or one reason that they don't come back because of the way they haven't been treated.
Gail.
I have three other comments I'd like to make. The first one is about training. I've learned a lot in the last 12 years doing a lot of training. And one of the things that I will tell you to kind of guard against is don't do like little in-services for a group of nurses here or a group of whatever there. It won't work. Those people come and go. Until it's policy and until it's written down, it's not going to happen, guys. You can train some of the people about customer service, but I always tell people if they provide really good customer service, they're probably doing just fine with people with disabilities. But I would recommend to you, if you're serious about training, you start at the top. You start with the administrator. You talk about policies. You talk about, because you've got to train on something. You've got to train on their policies, because if they're not in writing and if they're not policy, they don't have to do it.
They won't do it.
They won't have to. They won't do it, and they don't have to. So until it's a policy.
Sorry, but why do you say they don't have to?
Well, they don't have to from their point of view, in terms of their structure, their infrastructure.
You mean that people lower down in the system won't know what to do and don't feel like they have to do it because it's not written down?
Well, a lot of places, like institutions, like hospitals, go by the book. They go by what is the hospital policy, what does the administrator say, what's written down, and what do they have to do, because that's what they are held responsible for.
Got it.
So I would say to you, again, start at the top, really work on how you want to do your training. The second thing is, use your DBTAC, your Disability Business Technical Assistance Centers. There's an 800 number, and I don't have it in my head. I'm sorry.
And there are 10 of those throughout the country, right?
There are 10 of them throughout the country, and the 800 number will get you to your nearest one. They all have people who are kind of the part of the ADA network near you, and that person can help you maybe set up some training, or somebody from DBTAC can work on it with you. And what was the third thing? Oh, the third thing is, when I was looking at some of the stuff today, I found four different documents having to do with healthcare and healthcare facilities, and some of them were okay. They were questions and answers. And again, if you need those, let me know. Get to know those documents so that you can take them with you and show somebody. You know, the administrator's going to say to you, well, how do I know that, you know, that I have to do this? And you can actually show them some documentation.
Even though we can't remember the 800 number, since most of you will have computers, if you go to www.disability.gov, you can get to the DBTAC through the ADA link on that element. And there are also some of those healthcare documents located right on that disability.gov section. There's a whole health section that actually has quite a few documents that are worth taking a look at and represent good resources. Gail is going to get the DBTAC number. So let me see if people have other suggestions in terms of what we as the blindness community can do to make things better.
Education for the healthcare community. They seem to be the least educated, as far as I know, nurses, practitioners, that kind of thing. They need to know more about disability than they do at this point.
Yeah, I think it would be an interesting thing. Not that we all don't have enough advocacy on our plates, but I think it would be an interesting thing to do some research and find out where some of the healthcare associations hold their poopa big meetings and try to get on their agendas. And I think it also would be neat to have an ACB produced healthcare how-to when the patient has a visual disability or some such things that.
This is Allison. One of the things I suggested to the hospital administrator was I think it needs to even go back to the university. I mean, when I was working on my undergrad, I was required to take a special ed course. Now, grant you, it was just an overview of special ed, but my thought was, when I told the administrator, was maybe doctors and nurses should have a basic one-on-one on disabilities because they know all about illness and stuff, but when it comes down to common sense stuff about dealing with people with disabilities, maybe it should be part of the college curriculum.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. You would think that they would be more intelligent about the with regard to disability than they are, you know, and maybe what Marlena says about maybe ACB should do something, get involved some way to educate the healthcare professionals on how to, I mean, on their dealings with the blind and disabled.
Cool. Just while before we get too far from the topic, that 800 number for getting information about where your local DIBTAC is 1-800-949-4232. 1-800-949-4232. I think that the one other question that I guess I'd like to at least throw out on the table has to do with kind of long-term care and the kind that we receive in hospitals. Over the past year, I've talked with a number of people who are visually impaired who were in the hospital for really serious illnesses, who have complained about really inappropriate treatment in the hospitals and have suggested that there really is the need for what perhaps Marlena is talking about, which is, and certainly Gail is, for real infrastructural training that needs to be pretty insisted upon. I'm wondering whether this might actually be something that the American Foundation for the Blind might take on as a national project to develop and implement some training curricula that would be made available to all hospitals. Sometimes I think that an organization like AFB sadly may have more credibility with hospital administrators than an organization like ACB or NFB might have. And obviously that's just my opinion. Okay, last thoughts before we wind down for the evening. Any final thoughts that people have on the medical issues? Gail, did you have one?
I do. I keep coming back. If somebody has like a doctor's office, rec doctor's offices, and there are physical issues like elevators that don't have braille numbers or room numbers that aren't in braille, the doctor is partly responsible for that, but chances are they are renting space. So what you have to do is go to the building manager, figure out who owns the building. And this isn't always easy, by the way, and talk to them about making those changes. Again, the doctor has some responsibility, and if everybody says we don't have any, then you can find out when the lease is up and ask that it be negotiated somehow into the next lease. You also obviously can call the Department of Justice or take some other actions. Remember that there aren't any ADA police. We are it. ADA is a very much a complaint-driven law, so unless we do something or say something, it probably won't happen.
And we should probably say that the disability group that complains the least about the ADA are people who are blind. Okay, last thoughts.
I think it's important, and I think that the medical community is woefully ignorant on this fact, that a disability is not an illness. That if I go to the doctor because I have the flu, that's an illness that needs to be treated with maybe an antibiotic, maybe not, maybe drinking lots of juices. In other words, whatever they think the deal is with why I'm there, that's a treatable disease that they have treat. My blindness is not in the same category. I'm not sick because I'm blind. And I think that one of the reasons we get treated like do in the medical community is that they somehow equate disability with illness. And one of the gifts that the ADA and 504 gave us is the fact that is indeed not true. It's a disability, yes, but an illness, no. And I think the medical community is woefully ignorant of that fact.
Yeah, I think that the medical profession treats the disabled people like an illness, which is sadly an error for them to feel that way about it.
Okay, other final thoughts?
The fact that medical care, hospital care is going down, what are we going to do about that as far as our treatment. There are hospitals in this country where staff is being is shorthanded. How do we deal with that as well as our particular care as far as our special needs? I'm not talking about illness. You're right, Alice. I think you said that. How do we deal with the shorthandedness of the fact that the hospital situation is not as good as it used to be?
Well, I think you make a good point, Marcia, in that there are broader issues than just how folks are treated who are blind, and the shortage of staff in hospitals is certainly a major issue. We might also point out that the shortage of staff has actually led to the hiring and the importation of staff from other countries whose attitudes towards disabilities may be very different from those that we would expect, and therefore there's an increased likelihood with the number of folks who are working in hospitals who haven't had a lot of experience in the United States, there's a much greater likelihood that they will not know how to treat people with disabilities effectively. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate everyone being here for Tuesday Topics this evening. I think that this has been a very enlightening presentation. I hope everyone who's listening on ACB Radio will tune in next Monday. We will be having another Tuesday topic then. Again, I'd like to thank Rachel Bader for her technical assistance as our recorder. And I'd like to thank Dave Williams, who will be doing the editing of this broadcast. And, of course, I'd like to thank George Vise and Talking Communities for making it possible. I'm Paul Edwards. The medical community has a lot to learn. We have a lot to teach them. Thank you for tuning in to Tuesday Topics this evening and for participating. Good night. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll approach a question that's of importance to many of us who are blind and visually impaired. According to statistics, 70% of us are unemployed. One of the reasons that's true, perhaps, is that we haven't done a good job of choosing our careers. How ought blind people to choose careers? What kinds of resources are there out there to help blind people to choose careers? And what are the reasons that blind people don't maintain their jobs? These are just some of the issues that we'll discuss next week on Tuesday Topics, where we'll focus on the subject of choosing careers as blind people.